You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to the latest episode of Archaeology and Ale, a free monthly archaeology talk brought to you by Archaeology in the City, which is the community outreach programme from the University of Sheffield's Department of Archaeology. This month, our guest speaker is Andres Perez Arana, and his talk is entitled Archaeology Under the Radar, Remote Sensing and Geophysics for the Layman.
So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Steve Hollings, and on behalf of Archaeology in the City, I'd like to welcome you to our first Archaeology and Ale talk of the new semester. For the purpose of the podcast, we are at our spiritual home above the Red Deer in the heart of Sheffield, South Yorkshire. What we've got tonight is a newbie. So Andres is going to... I was going to say virgin, but I couldn't do that really.
Oh my god.
We're going to have a wonderful presentation, which will be put onto a podcast. So just in case Andres gets so carried away and so fast we can't understand him, I can either slow it down when I make the podcast, or you can play it at half speed. So we've got a half late. We've got about an hour's presentation with opportunity for questions after. So please be kind to him, look after him. He's our own Andres. Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you to Steve for organizing this event. Because, you know, this kind of thing is what keeps archaeology going. I want to thank the Red Deer as well for letting us stay here. I guess, do I need to introduce myself? As you can read there, I am Andres Perez Arana. I'm the teaching technician in fieldwork and remote sensing at the Department of Archaeology at the University of Sheffield. I deal with all the equipment and everything that makes beep, basically. So today I'm going to talk about, you know, vaguely about remote sensing and geophysics. I mean, it's kind of the things I do the most. I hope you don't fall asleep too much, and I hope my thick accent is not too hard to understand.
What did you say? You got it, Andres.
So, first thing, when people, you know, when a layman hears words like remote sensing, geophysics, radars, what kind of things comes to mind?
Something to say about the word layman?
So what people think about when you say like remote sensing, geophysics, radars? Well, you think time team doing actual geophysics, remote, yeah, like things you do on your TV. Radars is what the Americans used to chase the U-boats in the Second World War. But actually, what we mean when we say remote sensing is, as you can read there, is the acquisition of information about an object or phenomenon without making physical contact. It's basically non-destructive technique. This includes, it's a very wide range of techniques and approaches. Mainly it's aerial, satellite, and terrestrial sensors what we use, depending on where we are. And then we also can include in this category geophysics, even if in it's quite an Americanism to include geophysics into remote sensing, but it's becoming a trend now. So I guess we have to adapt. types of remote sensing, we can distinguish them by how do they collect the data. It can be an active sensing, is when the actual technique, the actual device, sends a pulse of energy or a pulse of something. It sends the energy that then is going to read later, or a passive sensor when it reads the data that comes from an external source. Very often is the sunlight, or it can be also the magnetic fields of the Earth. Another way to categorize remote sensing can be on how close to the object of study we are. So normally we divide them into three categories: spaceborne, satellite, rocket, airborne, airplanes, balloons, kites, if you like. Drones is the most recent one. And then is the ground-based ones, which is, well, close to the surface, whether it's the terrestrial surface or it's a water surface. We also can do like a bathymetric studies. So a lot of what we work about in remote sensing has to do with the electromagnetic radiation. The human eye can only see within the visible light spectrum, which is the rainbow colors, basically, as you can see. This is what we can see with the eyes, but there are things we cannot see just on the naked eye, as we say, and that goes from infrared, as everybody has heard of about infrared, microwaves, radio waves, or on the other side, ultraviolet, X-rays, or gamma rays. We don't normally use X-rays and gamma rays in remote sensing. That's other colleagues use it for other topics, like bone people. I don't know if there's any bone people here. they use them quite a lot. How is this defined? Is by the wavelength. So gamma rays and X-rays and ultraviolet, at some extent, are high energy, short frequency, while infrareds, microwaves, or radio waves are long wavelength. One could argue is less energy. So that's why, but it has less precision. So that's why you have, the FM, AM, long distance radios. You know, any person who has like a radio at home and speaks with people from the other side of the Atlantic, that's kind of radio waves that they can travel very far. While gamma rays, they are very short distance. And everything within that range, well, we try to use it for our own purposes. In this case, is to identify and study archaeology. This is very important for what we do. It is how crop marks and how the underground affects the topsoil. A lot of archaeology is covered under soil. These days is crop marks or grassland, pasture. This, what is underground, affects quite a lot the crops. So the most typical one will be a ditch, which has higher content of moisture with other top of with an infill of soils which tend to be newer and maybe richer, and for that reason the crops there grow better and higher. On the other hand, we have a wall or rubble or stones that will hinder the growth of the crops. So we play with this a lot, it's giving us so much information without putting a spade in the floor, in the ground. So the typical examples: this is the staple of British archaeology, ditch, pit. There's no posthole, but basically a posthole is a small pit, and walls. So let's go into different techniques. Well, aerial photography is the first technique used in history. It's not new, as you can see the photos. It has been used since the 19th century. All kind of techniques, like from balloons to kites, pigeons. Yeah, this I think it's in Germany, it's from Dresden. I think the Swedes doing crazy experiments with rockets and putting cameras in rockets and having like nice pictures of the Swedish countryside. And then all these booms since the First World War and the development of modern aviation, putting cameras. You know, if you can put a machine gun or a grenade, why not put a camera and shoot? I'm not killing anyone. The message is aerial photography is nothing new, but it has developed quite a lot in the last decades. I'm gonna put some example. Some of you may know this place. This is from Historic England, Aerial Archaeology Mapping Explorer, and you can see aerial photographs from Castleton in the Peak District. You can see some old photos, so we can use aerial photography to identify, well, how things have changed since then, because it's been almost 100 years now, so we can see changes in the last 100 years. We can also see things that don't appear in more modern You might.
Was that when Colin started excavating?
I think so. I think so. he can tell us. So yeah, this tool is very useful. It's the Aerial Archaeology Mapping Explorer. So you can see people already have been working on it, have been identifying medieval and post-medieval rich and furrow, Iron Age activity, medieval and post-medieval tracks. That is very fun because in this photo from 2005, you can see the tracks that have been digitized here. You can appreciate it. Right, carry on. Drones. Well, this is the last addition to... this is the last addition and a very useful tool. The magic of drones is that they have democratized aerial photography, something that before was very expensive and very time-consuming because you have to plan very well, and it was very expensive to put a plane in the sky. Now everyone for £100 can get a second-hand drone and start flying, as long as you are within the law, of course. Drones is definitely a game changer. With drones, you can stalk your colleagues. This is photos from Wales. But also you can do useful stuff like recording old buildings or landscapes or whatever you like. It gives you definitely a different perspective from ground level. Structure for motion is a very useful thing we can do with drones. It's basically a type of photogrammetry. We take several photos from different points of view, and then with different algorithms in certain softwares, we can create 3D models out of several images of the same object from different points of view. I don't want to spend too much time because this is for a different talk, and you can do things as this one. This is the same building I show you here. It's Middlesbrough Old Town Town Hall, basically. Now it's in ruins. You can see that the whole town center of Middlesbrough has been completely destroyed. We went a few months ago, and we flew the drone. We collect some photos also from ground level, and we made a nice 3D model of one of the oldest buildings in Middlesbrough. Also, with photogrammetry, we can create terrain models. If your GPS, if your drone has RTK, which is a high precision accuracy GPS, you can georeference your photos, and the photogrammetry will calculate how far away the drone is from the ground. And when you put all these photos together, you can create an actual elevation model with actual giving you values over the sea level. So these photos are from Sheldon, some of you may know. This is Sheldon, the hench we did last summer. And this is Newhall in Castleton. You can see the excavation and the spoil heaps. So to create these terrain models, we have to create a point cloud and a 3D model is what you can see in the bottom. So you can see each blue square is one single photo, one individual photo. So we put them all together. We need a heavy processing computers for this because it's very heavy. It's very heavy data. It's quite resource demanding. So once you put all these photos together, you can create these 3D models and these terrain models, and you can see here excavations. I don't know. It's like, can you see the trench number 2, trench number 1 in Sheldon, and excavation at Newhall there? Right. Again, this is Newhall excavation. You can also do with photogrammetry. You can also do orthomosaic, orthophotos, which is like a correct photo of the site. So you can check if someone is moving your stones around or bringing them home or something like that. These two photos are like 5 days apart from each other, and you can see the advance of the excavation. You can see this like little leg that's coming up here. You can see how the spoil heap is evolving. You can see how they went deeper in this. What was this, Colin?
The cellar.
The cellar, yeah. How they went deeper in this cellar. And they expanded a bit in these two, what were they, like flues or hearts? Or, I wasn't paying attention, sorry. uh, Anyway, other techniques. Let's move into other techniques. Multi and hyperspectral. This is when things get interesting, because we are going beyond the visual wavelengths. Multispectrals are usually composed of between 5 to 20 bands, and it covers the visible spectrum, but it also goes into the infrared, not the far infrared, only the near infrared, and it gets into the ultraviolets as well. It doesn't go the whole spectrum, because that would be too much. These machines. This is the typical multispectral camera with different channels. One is just a normal camera. The other ones are like different colors, so it's like the blues, the greens, the reds. And then, what's the difference between multi and hyperspectral? Well, the difference is the number of channels. I'm gonna go back and forth from these two slides. So as you can see, the limits between the both cameras is the same. Hyperspectral cannot go beyond what multispectral can go. The difference is the number of channels. So while in the multispectral you can, in multispectral you get like different levels, like stacked, in the hyperspectral you can make like gradients. It's like a continuum. So you can see here on the photo, like this is normal color, true color. Multispectral is more, how to say, the colors are starker, let's say, and hyperspectral is more, it's smoother. So depending on what you want to do, one technique or the other is more useful. So what do we do with the multispectral? It's like, okay, yeah, we collect all these fancy photos, what do we do with them? Well, we do, as you may know, in archaeology, we basically steal techniques from other disciplines all the time. So in this case, we are stealing the technique from farmers. This is what farmers use to identify the crop's health. So they use multispectral cameras, they see areas where the crops are not growing very well, and they say, okay, we need to put more fertilizer there, or insecticide, or whatever they need to make it better. So we take that from them, and we say, okay, well, probably if there's a Roman wall there, the crops are not going to like it. So they are probably going to go very, very brown, very red. Or on the opposite, if there's like a Bronze Age peat with full of organic material, well, the plants are really going to like that, because plants like organic material. So it's basically using these techniques on our own vantage. There are many indexes that can be used. NDVI is the most common one, because it stands for Normalized Difference Vegetation Index. How it's calculated, I don't want to bore you with a lot of like formulas and stuff like that. It's very simple. Is you take the near infrared, you subtract the red, and then you make a division of the near infrared plus the red, and then it gives you an index. And based on this index, then it tells you the health of the plant. This very briefly. Maybe someone here can tell it better. Maybe a plants person here. I don't know. but yes, for example, if the index is from minus one, it goes from minus one to plus one. So it has that range. So we have an index of minus one to zero. It basically means like a dead plant or an inanimate object. There's no life there. If we are looking at index from zero to 0.33, it's alive, but it's not very healthy. If it goes from 0.33 to 0.66, it's healthy, but it starts to show some signs of something's not right. And then from 0.66 up to 1 is a healthy plant. An example of multispectral imagery. This is from Green Hamerton. And yeah, apparently with this technique, they found an Iron Age settlement, these white lines here, and a Roman road going there. Other examples, I think this is from Spain. They use different techniques. It's the near infrared, one of the indices, the ENVDI. So just say this one is different to this one. I don't remember exactly the difference now, but there are different indexes. I was explained there's a whole plethora of different indexes that can be applied to the imagery. And here they found some structures as well, as you can see. I think these lines are modern. It's like agricultural activity, but the red lines are actual buildings. other examples from far away. They use different techniques like thermal. I will go to thermal soon. NDVI to identify structures in the countryside, and it looks very, very accurate. So you can see the layout much better than in the normal photography. More examples as you like. I can give you as much as you like. Thermal cameras. This is another technique we use on drones. It's quite useful. It plays with the difference, the thermal difference moisture generates on different types of material. So it's normally the difference between the natural soil and the archaeological element. So here you have a little diagram where you can see, for example, you have a concentration of artifacts on the surface. They will normally will gather, they will heat more than the rest. So in a thermal photography, they will appear as hotter than the rest of the soil. You have a ditch or a pit, it will concentrate more moisture, similar as I have it with the crop marks. More moisture means more water means cooler. So the thermal photo will identify that area as cooler than the rest, so we can pinpoint it. A wall is the opposite, it will gather heat, it will be drier, so when the water evaporates, that area will be warmer than the rest, etc, etc, etc. So the trick of thermal photography is you have to choose when you are doing your survey, because there are optimums through the day. As you can see, the dry soil during the day heats much more than the moist. So you need to, what people normally do, they look for the coolest part of the day. So they normally fly the drones in the night just before or by dawn. So they use this curve here to pick the optimum of the difference. Because one say, oh yeah, why don't you use the hottest part of the day? Well, what will happen at that time in many places, I don't say this always what happens, everything will be too hot. Yeah, true, the dry soil will be hotter, but everything will be too hot for the camera to distinguish. So people tend to look for the coolest part of the day. Yeah, some examples. Roman villas. Who doesn't like a Roman villa? A Roman villa, very, very clearly identified with thermal photography. This is the same field. If you didn't tell me there was a Roman villa here, I would never guess it. I mean, now I can see the lines vaguely, but otherwise, I would have never guessed it. Yeah, there are other factors that affect can be used for thermal photography, but I don't want to bore you too much. LiDAR, well, LiDAR, LiDAR is fantastic. It's a super, has revolutionized the life of archaeologists in the last, you know, 5 years, 10 years. It's fantastic. LiDAR stands for light detection and ranging. It's a remote sensing method, as it says, and it consists on, it's basically a laser. It's basically a laser like this one, but stronger. So it sends a laser down the ground, normally it's on a plane. Now people are starting to do it on drones as well. And it sends pulses down the ground, and the laser bounces back. Then the receiver calculates how long does it takes to bounce back, and it can tell you the distance. Very, very briefly speaking. What is the advantage of LiDAR? It can penetrate vegetation. So a normal aerial photography on forests or on long grass, you cannot see what's below that, or bushes, you cannot see what's there. With LiDAR, you can see the actual model. So, and it's so versatile, because if you're interested in actual, you're interested in the actual forest, You can create a digital surface model, because it's also pinging that down. So you have, because it has like several returns. First return, second return, third return. So you have several returns, so you can choose which layers do you want to keep. You can filter the data. So for those interested in buildings or objects poking out from the, you know, sticking out from the ground, you have the digital surface model, when you can see the data sticks to the actual surface. But if you don't want them, you can filter them down and create a digital terrain model. And then you stick to the bare surface of the soil, and that's what we archaeologists normally like, because we can find archaeology where previously we couldn't find it. Like, as I said, normally forest, overground areas, you name it. Some good examples of LiDAR. Well, the first one is the impressive one. It is Tikal in Guatemala. It's like a Mayan city. It's fantastic. I've been there. It is impressive. You go up the pyramids. You just see a sea of green. Sorry, I'm diverging now. Sorry. So in these kind of jungles, LiDAR has been a revolution. Like since in the last 10-15 years, it's been fantastic, and you can get like models of the actual city getting out of all the vegetation. Is wonderful. A bit closer to home, we have other examples when LiDAR has been useful. Some of you may recognize these places. This is Caerlechwy in Wales. It's a Roman fort we are working at. And in the LiDAR, you can see the bank perfectly going there. Yeah. But then wait for later, because there's more about this. And in the bottom, there is Sheldon. It's the hench we were digging as well last summer. So you can barely see it on the satellite imagery, but on the LiDAR, it's so clear. The bank and the ditch. Okay, well, enough of being up in the sky. Let's safely touch ground now. These are all photos from when I used to work in commercial archaeology. Good memories when we got the quad bike stuck in the mud. So yeah, let's go back to the ground, but not that badly. Maybe it's a good time to, I don't know, it's like, should I have someone questions about what we've been talking so far? Because now we're going to move into the terrestrial techniques. So we are moving away from the aerial ones. No? Keeping them for later? Very well. That gives me time to drink some water. He's brewing it. All right. Well, now we're going to move into the terrestrial techniques. Most part of them are geophysics. The king of these techniques so far is the magnetic surveys. Magnetic surveys, we use them, especially in Britain, are used everywhere all the time. They're versatile, it's quick, and gives you quite good results. Here we got some examples. We have some weirdo here using a dual magnetometer. Have some people here using a single one, cards, and tout cards. There's so many ways of collecting data. The principle is very simple. It uses magnetic fields to identify what's laying underground. As you can see in the picture, like this kind of like a Neanderthal here wearing a magnetometer. Magnetometer is the generic word for the instrument. Gradiometer refers to a certain kind of configuration of magnetometers. So as a rule of thumb, that's how you say it, rule of thumb. All gradiometers are magnetometers, but not all magnetometers are gradiometers. How the gradiometer works? Basically, it's composed of two magnetometers. You can see in the machine, one on the top, one on the bottom. They both pick changes in the magnetic fields. I will go later on how these magnetic fields work. And then they average the readings to remove the background noise, because the Earth has its own magnetic fields, and there's magnetic noise all over the place. So we need to filter that. This helps to filter it down, and then we can focus on the actual magnetic properties of the soil where we're standing. It is as I said, a very useful technique. Here is an example. They did a magnetic survey. They identify these strong anomalies here, and they decide to excavate one of them. And bingo, they have a pit with organic material inside, I think it is. So yeah, it's proving its effectivity. How it works? Well, as I said, it's based on the Earth magnetic fields. The magnetic fields are constantly going in the Earth. I don't want to get too much into this, because we are archaeologists. We are not physicists. The magnetic fields is a constant flux of energy. This passive technique can measure that flow. Sounds very new age, isn't it? Sorry, I come back. Other principles, it's the remanent magnetization, and this one is at the same time is related with the thermal remanescence. So when, for example, a volcano erupts, all the particles, all the materials that are in it aligned, when it's in a lava state, aligns with the current magnetic field, because as you know, the magnetic field changes over geological eras. So there's been times when the North Pole has been what we understand to now as the South Pole. You all know that already, don't you? So, and it shifts as well. It oscillates as well. It oscillates. So it's also used as a detection technique, if you want to know. Anyway, so these deposits align with the current magnetic field of the Earth, and when the lava solidifies, they solidify as well. They stay in that position. After, when they become dust or debris, they end up and they fall into a water body, for example, the bottom of the sea or a lake. They will get the magnetic position as they, when they fall down, when they touch ground as well. So there are different moments in these particles when they align. Another thing is the magnetic susceptibility, is how some materials gain or lose magnetic properties. There was this French guy, this clever French guy decided to put his name on it. It's Le Born mechanism. And for example, yeah, like hematite reduces and becomes magnetite. In that process, it gains more magnetic enhancement, and then it oxidizes and it becomes magnemite, and it does the most magnetic element. It happens for several reasons, like fermentation, biochemical. This is just to give you like some ideas. I don't want to get into the bog of hard science now, because it's not the scope of this talk. But if you have questions, you can ask me later. Typical results from a magnetic survey. For example, one of the typical results for magnetometer, why magnetometer is good for, is for fire. For fire or fire-related activities, such as identified kilns or fire clay, like brick walls, they appear as magnetic. So you can see here in this graphic, this wall made of bricks peaks, has like a strong positive, and then drops down in a slightly negative dipole. Things like wall, that some stones are not magnetic, like sandstone. Sandstone is not magnetic. But if the soil where it stands has some enhancement, then it will appear as a negative because it's less magnetic than the rest. So it can go both ways. You can have a low magnetic background with a high magnetic feature, or you can have a high magnetic background with a low magnetic feature. It goes both ways. And then you can have, the strength of the anomalies will depend on how close to the surface they are, so the closer they are and how concentrated they are, because for example you have like a small high magnetic feature there, it will be very very small. If it's broad, it won't peak that much, but it will be wider in its imprint, in its signature. For example, here you see depth is important. If your feature is near the surface enough to be picked by the magnetometer, it will appear, and depending on the magnetic properties, it will be stronger or more strong or less strong. But if it's deep enough, you won't detect it. So it doesn't mean, so people need to understand this, like in geophysics, just because it doesn't appear in the data doesn't mean there's nothing there. Other examples are the state of the actual feature. For example, this is different. This is the same material, bricks, but this is a wall that hasn't been disturbed. So it's like one solid block of data, one peak. Well, here is like rubble, and the rubble is creating like different peaks of in the data. Okay, sorry, the sound. Other typical anomalies, well, we can have in situ burning, that's like hearts or kilns. They are very characteristic for this double peak. It goes up, then down, and then up again. So it makes like a cat face. This is typical of in situ burning. Then you have ferrous stuff, like, you know, when the farmer breaks the plow or a horseshoe, there will be like scatter ferrous debris, and they make like very small but very strong positive and negative peaks. Peak, peak, up, down, up, down. Then you can have concentrations of ferrous, because when someone spread rubbish from a demolition, for example, and they spread it, it will look like this, like speckled. And then we have like geological features as well, because different geology has different magnetic properties. For example, we have like pockets of sand and gravel, and they appear like this, but they are much, how to say, they are like smoother. They're smoother. And they don't have peaks. It's like, it's just positive. They don't have like a counter negative part, like in the ferrous spikes. What causes this? Well, all kind of things, like, well, mainly the usual suspects are ferrous objects, burning of firing, as I said before, fermentation. This is strong for organic material. Sometimes you will find pits with decades and centuries of organic material deposition, you know, like plants, your dead cattle. You throw it all into that pit, and the decomposition, the bacteria, enhance the magnetic properties of the pit. And you can see, for example, in this graphic here, you can see a pit. This is a typical. Excuse my pulse. This is a typical, only positive, organic pit. There are magnetotactic bacteria, but that's not very common in Britain. It's more common in northern France and Germany. It's because it's associated with the lowest landscapes and the composition of wood in that kind of landscape. And then, well, we have like modern magnetic debris, like farmers like to throw green waste these days. And green waste enhances the magnetic field and very often masks the archaeology below. Right, this is an example. This is from my adventures in Spain. This is a possible marching Roman fort. You can see it vaguely on the satellite imagery. You can see the line there making a right angle. Some people claim it's a Roman fort. It's not definitely clear yet, but it could be. So I did a magnetometer survey, a magnetic survey, and it's very faint because the content of iron in this soil is quite high, so it's very speckled. So you can see the line going up and then turning there. It's very hard to see, but it's there. I've been looking at this data for too many hours. I promise you. But why the magnetic survey was useful? Well, it was useful especially for this little corner in the bottom, because on the satellite imagery, the landowner changes, and this person here uses the land in a different way, so we cannot see the crop marks. Thanks that I have this crazy idea of doing a little corner in the bottom just to see what happens, and I think we got the corner of the fort there. You can see it very briefly. If you don't see, don't worry. It's hard to see. Electrical resistivity is another technique we use. There are two types of electrical resistivity. There's ERT. ERT is electrical resistivity tomography. This is a very cool article I was reading the other day. They are using like high density tomography. So they're basically doing how it works. You put a lot of probes in a line, and then you send like an electrical current, as you can see here. This is how it should be, but it's not like that. It's like this. So you put probes and you send an electrical current, and this current creates arches between probes, and depending on how the material resists the flow of the electricity will tell you the properties, and then you can identify this like obstacles or not. So they make, in this experiment, they make these lines, I think every 25 centimeters. It's very, very time consuming, but the results are very good. So, because later they excavated and then they got the walls bang on. And the same data on profile looks like this. So you have the walls with high resistivity. You have the wall, this is on a profile, this is in front. So that's why you cannot see that, that well. And then you have the moisture, more moisture area under the wall. This is the most common application of resistivity. Everyone who has been involved in some field work probably has been doing some of this. It's the mobile probes. It's basically how this works. You put two remote probes in a fixed place that will give you like constant, kind of like a constant value, and then you move the remote probes in a certain interval that you set up, and that will give you different readings each time. So depending on what is under the ground, the electricity will go faster or slower. So for example, again, as we were saying, if you have a wall, the electricity will struggle to pass through the wall because it's drier. So the resistivity will be higher. On the opposite, if you are under a ditch or a pit which has more moisture, then the electricity will go faster, because electricity goes faster when there's more moisture. And hence you will have a low resistivity value. And many commercial units say, well, resistivity is not useful anymore because it's very slow. And it's true, it's slower compared to a magnetometer or radar or other techniques. But it still has its value, still has its value. There's an example here. This is the same place. They did a magnetometer survey and they picked like very nice ditches. These are ditches with the infill, yeah, that's fine. Boundaries, plowing marks. But there's a big lump here. It's not very clear what it is. And then they did a resistivity survey and boom, Roman Villa. Why this happens? Because Roman Villa probably was made with brick. The brick, being fire clay, creates too much noise for the magnetometer, because it's, as I explained before, it's enhanced. So you cannot see, you cannot define the edges of the walls. On the other side, the resistivity is not subject to the magnetic properties. It doesn't care about of magnetism, it cares about the electricity. Then they got the walls very well defined. They didn't got the ditches so well, but that's why the more techniques you use on your surveys, the better. Other good advantages of the resistivity is like it's low cost compared to a radar, for example. It's very good for community projects or low budget research projects. So here we have some examples. This is from Wales. We were having some volunteers to help us. It's also very collaborative because you need 2-3 people to work around. So it's very nice to involve members of the public into these surveys. So we have the volunteers helping. This is Luke. This is from Spain. It's also quite easy. It's quite sturdy. So it's easy to travel with it as well if you can pack it well. We have someone here. Someone in the room look like this. this is from Spain in September, and this is something I found on internet. It's the Scarborough Archaeological Society or something like that. It's like a local society that is interested in archaeology, and they were very happy because they just recently they bought this resistivity meter and they were trying it out. So it's like, you know, something very very good for community projects and local groups. These results are from last spring in Wales. It's the Roman Ford I showed you on LiDAR before. This is the resistivity data. And you can see here a nice building, probably the Principia, which is the headquarters, the roads, a ditch, the ditch, some more streets there, the road leading to the north as well. Probably this is like one of the bank and ditch here, the defenses. So yeah, of course, the granary. The Horrea, here you can see it's very typical Roman granary. The interpretation is in the bottom, sorry. And well, the star of the show, and I'm not talking about Alleluia. I'm talking about the GPR. Ground penetrating radar is a very versatile tool, because it can be used in different contexts that other techniques won't be useful. For example, indoors or on built surfaces like stones, tarmac, concrete. but they also can be used in the countryside as any other technique. So we have some photos here from previous surveys we've done. Like these two are from Spain. This is from these two are from the Sheffield General Cemetery. And this is me when I was in commercial in Sweden doing looking for Viking burials and houses. So yeah, so how does the GPR work? Well, the GPR send pulses. It's composed of a transmitter and a receiver. It has a transmitter and a receiver, and what it does, it sends a pulse down the ground, and then when it hits something, it bounces back. It's quite similar to LiDAR, as I was explaining before. It hits something, bounces back, and then the receiver measures the time it takes to get the signal back. So you can set up the radar to send the pings, send the pulses as many as you like. So you can say like send one every 2 centimeters, every five centimeters. You can adjust that. The more readings you have, the more detailed your data is going to be. It's simple. So what happens when you have an object buried underground? Your transmitter hits it on the side of it, and then bounces back. And then as you get close to it, the time it takes to bounce back takes less. And then as you move away, it takes longer again. That's why in GPR, signals normally look like hyperbolas, because it's this effect. In other cases, when you have like a floor or a geological layer, it's basically like, it's just like a line and it follows like this. Yeah, so as I was saying, there are two types of reflectors. It's all about reflection. So you have point reflectors. It's like individual objects, small objects normally, and they create this kind of hyperbola. And then you have planar reflectors, which, as I say, is like floors or geological horizons. You can also have like walls, like this typical wall, because it doesn't create this effect typical of a pipe or a single stone. Walls are more compact. As well, there are filters to avoid to correct this curving. So if you apply the filter, your object will be right where it should be, because the actual location, you know, your object will never be as big as it looks like. It's always going to be, the actual location of your object will be on the top of your curving line there. The size of the object you can detect depends on how deep they are. So on the surface, you can detect smaller objects. The deeper you go, the bigger the object has to be detected. It's clear. Then radars. We use different types of frequencies for the radars. There are a whole plethora of range. So because radar is not just for archaeology, it's also used for geology. The oil industry is constantly using GPRs. People looking for pipes, services. GPR is not just for archaeologists, as many things in this world. So depending on the kind of survey you want to do, you will have to choose the type of antenna frequency you would like to use. Normally, in archaeology, people use between the 500. They go between the 250 up to 1,000. I've never seen in archaeology more than that. This is the range. And normally it's around 500. So the most standard GPR you will see in archaeology will be like 450, 500. Some people use 800. The one we have in the department is 600 and 170. So one frequency for surface objects, one frequency for deeper down, more geological levels. And just to give you an example, I brought here the same profile of data collected with two different antennas. So the one here is a bit counterintuitive, because the 500 is this one and the 250 is this one. So you can see the 250 goes deeper down, has more range, but it has less detail on each individual anomaly, while the 500 cannot go as deep as this one, but everything in this range has much more detail and is more enhanced. So yeah, as I say, depending on what you want to find, if you know your place before you do your physics is the moral of the story. Again, some advantages. Well, it's super versatile. can be used in for all kind of like, can be used in modern and built up environments. Effective in a wide range of anthropic activity that other techniques won't do it. It's very good for structures, walls, floors. Also, is the most used for burials as well, detecting burials. Like people in forensics use it quite a lot as well. And yeah, the radiograms are displayed in real time, so you can see your data as you walk. So you can start having an idea of what you are getting as you go. Of course, it's raw data; you need to process it later for better results. Disadvantages: well, the data processing is very time-consuming because you can go as detailed as you like, because you have several levels of depth. So you can go 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters. You can go as detailed as you like. So it's very, very time consuming to process and interpret the data. But it's a double-edged blade because it gives you much more information, but then you have to deal with that information as well. It doesn't work that well in saturated clays or very moist areas because the water scatters and the clay absorbs the signal. But still, you can get some decent results in these kind of conditions anyway. And then, yeah, well, modern features, like especially like metal, you have like metal objects on the surface, like rubbish, like Coca-Cola cans and metal sheets that someone left in the ground. Masks creates this kind of, it's called ringing, it's a ringing effect. It's like a mirror, basically the signal bounces back fully, so covers the data below this object. So yeah, modern rubbish can mask the data below it. This back to our Roman fort in Wales. This is the GPR data. Again, we have our Principia, we have our Horrea, we have the road, we have a wall there, some streets, some roads, and I don't know if you can see, but here between the roads, we can even see like the individual cells where probably the legionaries were living. And then we have the defenses here, the bank and ditch. And hopefully this year we will carry on this way and we will find out if there's a vicus associated with it. But that's for next year. Another example is Sheldon. With the GPR in Sheldon, I showed you Sheldon as well in the LiDAR section as well. It's very clearly, you can see here the ditch and the entrance, and some internal weird anomalies that I would like to find out what they are. So we should dig there at some point. But yeah, like this summer they did excavations here. They put one trench here, one trench there. Some of you were there actually, and the ditch is there. So it's real. This is another way of displaying the data. This is like a multi slice. Sometimes it's useful, sometimes it's not. It just gives you like, instead of showing only one level of depth, it tries to bring you all the depths based on a color ramp. So you can see the difference. It's like inside the hinge and outside. So it gives you some information. This is from our project in Spain in September. We were looking for, well, I have to tell you the story. How are we doing in time? Okay, we are almost done. Well, in this village, someone in the 50s had the happy idea of getting rid of the, someone had the happy idea in the 50s to get rid of the ruins of the castle and put a bullring on it. Yes, that's Spain under Franco for you. So they basically put, I think they put like dynamite to flood it down. They flooded down the castle and built this bullring. So we went there, before we went there, the winter before, they did some excavations and they found this massive wall. It's like a 2 meters wide wall from the medieval castle. So they say, oh, why don't we do some GPR to try to find if there's more wall about this castle? It's like, oh yeah, let's go, let's do it. So, or any structure associated with it. Sorry. So yeah, we did that, and we have some. So actually, it's quite good results. So you can see on the radiograms. These are the radiograms. This is the slices. So here, this black line here corresponds with this wall. So you can see the wall goes there, and then turns like 90 degrees up, right? and this is how the wall looks like on the profile of the radar. It's nice and square. Then we say, okay, well, let's, because the castle was square and the bullring is round, so we probably can get the corners of the castle. So let's say, instead of, well, we did the survey inside, but they say, well, why don't we do the survey around as well? So we went around, and actually, well, there's a line here that is very misleading, because this is a pipe. But if you look at this dark blob here, this is actually the wall, and it aligns very well. And in the profiles, you can see very well the difference. This is why the profiles are important. This here, this kind of like rectangular shape here, that's the wall. This curvilinear thing is the pipe. And they go parallel to each other. Well, not quite, but a little bit. Right, and then by the same token, if you follow this line, curiously, there's a black dot there. And if you project this way, there's another one here. So I think we have parts of the castle still there. Of course, it's in the middle of the town, so I don't know if they will dig it either. And then the other very important thing is the thing in the middle. This massive thing is right in the middle of the castle. We don't know for sure what it is. We were considering it could be part of the keep. Definitely an underground, like, because the keep is completely destroyed. So it's sort of like an underground feature associated with the keep, probably like a cistern or a well, or if you want to get creative, a dungeon. It's probably like a well more than anything, and you can see it very well here on the profile. And then I learned a few things about bullrings as well, because I didn't know. I'm a Spanish myself. I didn't know this. Bullrings have drainage systems as well, because this is modern drainage around the bullring. Well, I think that's it for today. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Andres. That was brilliant. Do we have any questions?
Can I ask, is there any particular problem going through tarmac? Say for, it's very level tarmac. Looking at footings, maybe 4 foot, 6 foot down.
Yeah.
Particular problem with GPR.
No, radar should be able to go through tarmac, yes.
I asked because I'm talking about bolts of stone.
The problem is if they put reinforcing bars, that's when there's a problem. They put like metal bars, but I don't think people put metal bars on tarmac, isn't it?
Reinforced concrete though.
Yeah. Yeah, they should be fine.
Angela?
Can magnetometry go through tarmac?
No, because the tarmac has magnetic properties in itself, because you need to warm.
GPR is the only technique for the tarmac.
Yes.
Matthew?
How interpreting images clearly is quite an expert thing. How much will AI help?
AI? Well, quite a lot. And there's people already looking into that. Yeah, there's people doing research on intelligent identification of features. Yes, it's a bit complicated because archaeology is human made, so not all archaeology looks the same. You know, you can have a burrow. Not all burrows are perfect circles. So AI is struggling a little bit so far, but I'm pretty sure in the future, as the AI gets better and more clever, it will be possible to automatize identification of features. Yeah.
And it'd be cheaper than you as well, wouldn't it?
Well, exactly. I'm not that expensive. I just need a pint of beer. All right.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Which is your favourite method and why?
That's a good question. It's like, you know, who's your favourite, mum and dad? It's like, all of them has a thing, isn't it? Like, each one of them have a thing. Like, GPR is nice, but it's very time consuming. I guess magnetometer is the one I've used more in my life, so I guess I'm more attached to magnetometer because it's the one I've done the most. But I recognize GPR as being very useful and very, very resourceful. And then there's all the aerial techniques as well are very interesting. LiDAR is like, I don't know how can people live without LiDAR these days.
Matthews, come back.
Back to computing, I'm afraid. Is are there standards for the publication of data out of the equipment itself, and sufficient that you can interchange between different pieces of software? Or is it all very manufacturer specific?
There are some guidances. Yes, there are some they're not set rules, but there are some guidances. Yes. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there are some softwares like the one we use for interpreting processing GPR data. They are very clever. They don't reverse engineering. So they take each manufacturer and they adapt the software to the different manufacturers, but it's like a third party software.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Did I answer your question?
But it's also sort of saying it's not the sort of thing that the without expertise you can get your teeth into.
I mean, if you're really into it, you can learn it. It's like
pay for it.
If you want to, yes. I know people who have learned coding on their own and they made like data processing softwares, and okay. And they weren't IT people. There's people who learn Python in their spare time. Uh-huh. So because it's mainly Python what it's mainly used.
And of course, now you've been sacked. You've got plenty of time for doing this.
I'd
love to
question, yes.
Any more questions? Right, that's the case. Then we'll say thank you again to Andreas, and then we'll go and pass by.
Thank you for listening to Archaeology and Ale. For more information about our podcast and guest speaker, please visit our page on the Archaeology Podcast Network. You can get in touch with us at Archaeology in the City on Facebook, WordPress, Instagram, or X. If you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.